Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is an Empowerment Hour. Lots of good information coming your way today to help you live a longer and healthier life. Of course, we always begin with the latest on health and healing, including, well, the benefits of avocado today, dealing with that bad cholesterol that many people have. Also, how optimism leads to a healthier heart. And then we're going to look at what is the ideal amount of vitamin D to improve immunological parameters, especially if you're a sick person, even with HIV. Then we're going to look at how you can have better vascular impact with a anti-hypertensive, anti-thrombotic diet. I'll tell you the diet. 160 nations have banned growth hormone in meat, but not the United States. Well, if you're eating meat, as many people are, you should know what's in that meat, and we'll go through what's in it and why it's not good for you and why you should see about going vegan for health reasons, if none other. There are a lot of good reasons to do it. Also, there are key amino acids and their important role in your health. And then we're going to get into some deeper material. We're going to take a look, for example, at Big Pharma's diabolical plan to destroy the vitamin herbal supplement industry, an article from Global Research. We're also going to explore, don't believe everything that you read about flu deaths. The peer-reviewed Journal of Advanced Practice Nursing had an article. I will read it to you. It is really revealing. From our social justice column today, the police were created to control working class and poor people. From Law and Working Class History Association, Sam Mitrani. We're also going to take a look today at some psychiatrists are beginning to distance themselves from the profession as drug company dominance makes some psychiatrists very rich, and many patients very overdrugged. Who's telling this? Dr. Bruce Levine from Alternet. My guest in the second part of our program today, talking about the rise of heroin abuse and dependency among the young, educated, affluent whites, Dr. Dale Archer, board-certified psychiatrist, a distinguished fellow of the American Psychiatric Association, and founder of the Institute of Neuropsychiatric Studies down in Louisiana. As you see, we have a lot to share. And then I'll try to set time aside, if we can, for some talk back, your opportunity to call in and share your points of view. I want to start, however, with a look at something that we don't pay attention to, and we don't give it value when we do. And that is, according to the latest survey from Samantha Hemingway, from Health Solutions Foundations, psychiatric drugs send 90,000 to emergency rooms each year. A recent Journal of the American Medical Association psychiatry study revealed that there are an estimated 267,000, over a quarter million, emergency room visits because of adverse drug events from psychiatric drugs such as overdose, excessive sleepiness, head injuries. Over 19% of these emergency room visits resulted in patient hospitalization. Now, the lead author of the Journal of the American Medical Association study suggests the need for caution, increased surveillance, and reduced use of psychiatric drugs, and even encourage alternative treatments. We certainly support that. But when you consider the fact that we have more Americans today taking antipsychotic, antidepressives, sedatives, than ever before in our history, something's wrong. Now, this data is no surprise to this audience, because you're aware of the dangers of psychiatric drugs. In fact, last year, more than 1 million American children, 2-0 to the age of 5, were prescribed psychiatric drugs. And there were over 10 million children over that age given drugs for ADHD. 41 million Americans took antidepressants, and more than 6.5 million took antipsychotics, and 36 million took anti-anxiety drugs. 79 million Americans, one in every four, are currently prescribed psychiatric drugs. This is shocking. This is a pandemic. In an effort to provide accurate information about the documented risk associated with psychiatric drugs, there have been leading mental health watchdogs that have brought this public, but no one is paying attention and the mainstream media is not touching it. So what is the issue? The issue is that there is no legitimate scientific rationale for the diagnostic procedures and the treatment scheduling and the drugs given that ends up leading to high incidence of suicide or attempted suicide. Now, men and women attempt suicide about the same. The difference is, and this is why the studies are misleading, women will make an attempt to commit suicide, but not as serious as men. Men get heavy duty at it. Men don't cut their wrists. Men put a gun in their mouth, blow their brains out. And so it's about 4-1. So there's actually more women attempting suicide, not succeeding. And all of this, of course, is drawing attention to oneself. They need help. In our society, we have no effective mental health system. It is a disaster. So crude, so vile, so criminal, so insensitive, so uncaring, that I'm putting my energies into the fifth year of a major documentary. And it's called Manufactured Madness. Manufactured in that we do not have legitimate diagnostic procedures. The statistical manual for psychiatry is no better than a comic book. It has no legitimacy. There is no science involved. There is no blood chemistry, no MRI. There is no accurate diagnostic technique or method to determine what you have. The trouble is we all have problems in life. We all have some measure of inability to cope at different times, sometimes transient, very short, sometimes prolonged, chronic. Sometimes we cannot give up on grieving. Sometimes we have a hard time getting over loss of a relationship, of a job, of our youth, of our vitality. A lot of men go through not a midlife crisis, but when you can't get an erection and you have no sexual desire and you begin to pull away from the people who are so important and have been in your life and you don't know how to express yourself, we don't have anyone there to counsel and encourage and show that, hey, buddy, you just have some low free testosterone. We can change that. We can get your testosterone back naturally, and therefore your vitality comes back. We can get your muscles strong again. We can burn that belly fat. We can get human growth hormone going. That workout in the morning will get some wonderful endorphin hormones secreted in your body for the next 6 hours. You'll feel better. You'll have a pick-me-up day. But we don't have that. Instead, first we make the mistake of blaming someone for being emotionally distant. They're not at fault. Their biochemistry is. It is no different than when a woman is going through excruciating pain and cramps and nausea and she begins to act out emotionally. That's not her fault. That's the hormones at work. And yet when we learn how we can intervene in a natural way and help a woman do a period of time, let's say a week before her menses, and therefore the cramps are not there, the nausea is not there, the mood swings are gone. It's a wonderful relief if you've been the person who suffered with it. So it's not the woman's fault. You see, we get too excited about blaming people for what could be changed. And yet medicine says, you have a psychiatric disorder. You need a drug, and we have them. Now, there are psychiatrists and psychologists and behavioralists and psychotherapists in the United States who do a very good job, and they actually help people because they do it the old-fashioned way. They sit and listen and help the person understand what is wrong, out of balance in their life, and help them to rebalance themselves emotionally. But modern psychiatry has now been controlled completely by pharmaceutical industry. And they see it differently. They see you as a commodity. You are a customer for life. Now, Dr. Bruce Levine from Alternet is very keen on this, and he is one of the most articulate, courageous, outspoken persons on this subject. And he said this, quote, "What's a guy got to do around here to get a little credibility?" asks ProPublica's reporter Jesse Eisinger in a piece about top Wall Street executives who created the financial meltdown but remain top executives, continue to sit on corporate and nonprofit boards and serve as regulators, and whose opinions are sought out by prominent op-ed pages and talk shows. Now here's the deal. Wall Street is not the only arena where one can be completely wrong and still retain power and influence. Influential, what I call, dominant policymakers or opinion leaders. The new term on the street is thought leaders. And psychiatrists and major psychiatric institutions, by their own recent admissions, have been repeatedly wrong about illness and disorder validity and biochemical causes. Oh, you've got a brain chemical imbalance. No, you don't. There is no such thing. It doesn't exist. It's never existed. And they know it. But if you watch the ads, if you look at that little script at the bottom of the ad when they're trying to get you on their tranquilizers, it says, "We believe." Oh, hold on. Your belief is worthless. Your proof, irrefutable by a gold standard, double-blind, placebo-controlled, done at least six times with the same outcome by independent, non-affiliated people, that would impress me. You believe that there's a brain chemical imbalance, and you believe that your selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, your Paxil, your Prozac, your Effexor, will help a person. You believe that their suicide is not due to your prescription drug. You believe that normal kids, normal teenagers who had wonderful lives, were vivacious, outgoing, challenging, suddenly suffer from parental defiance disorder, math defiance disorder, social anxiety disorder, and therefore need your drugs. And when they commit suicide and hang themselves in their bedrooms, you think that that is normal? Well, that's the way it is. In several cases, the entire field of psychiatry, except for those engaged in interpersonal dialogue, have been discovered to be on the take, pimps for drug companies. Yet they continue to be taken seriously by the mainstream media. That is an affront against all that is right. And while big pharma financial backing is one reason psychiatry, a completely, totally debunked, fraudulent, unscientific cult, as it is currently practiced through the pharmaceutical model, not the traditional model that had legitimacy and helped people, is still able to retain its clout. This is not the only reason. One more insidiously, psychiatry retains influence because of the needs of the larger power structure that rules us. Now think about this for a moment. Just think. Perhaps most troubling, psychiatry retains influence, and our increasing fears that have resulted in our expanding needs for coercion. But before discussing three reasons, some documentation of psychiatry's lost scientific credibility in several critical areas. First, psychiatry has none, zero scientific credibility. Let us be very specific. The DSM, The DSM stands for the Diagnostic Statistical Manual. It is completely invalid. The American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic Bible, the DSM, was slammed by the pillars of psychiatry, Thomas Insull. You don't know who he is, but he is the director of the National Institute of Mental Health. That's the highest U.S. government mental health official. Offered a harsh rebuke of the DSM, announcing that the DSM diagnostic categories lack validity, and stated, quote, "The National Institute of Mental Health will be reorienting its research away from the diagnostic and statistical manual categories." Also, Dr. Alan Francis, the former chair of the DSM-4 task force, published his book, Saving Normal, An Insider's Revolt Against Out-of-Control Psychiatric Diagnosis, DSM-5, Big Pharma, and the Medicalization of Ordinary Life. Totally destroyed what he had once been in charge of directing, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, where they make up all these categories by vote, by opinion. And now, next is the biochemical imbalance theory of psychiatry. It is total garbage. There is nothing scientific about it. It was a great surprise for NPR reporter Alex Spiegelman in 2012 to discover that the psychiatric establishment now claims it has always known that the biological biochemical model of imbalance theory of depression was not true. Ronald Pius, editor-in-chief emeritus of the Psychiatric Times, stated, quote, "In truth, the chemical imbalance notion was always a kind of urban legend, never a theory seriously propounded by well-informed psychiatrists," end quote. The National Institute of Mental Health director I just mentioned, Dr. Insull, had already told Newsweek in 2007 that depression is not caused by low levels of neurotransmitters such as serotonin. However, psychiatry made no serious attempt to publicize the fact that the research had rejected this chemical imbalance theory, a theory effectively used in commercials that sell antidepressants as correlating this chemical imbalance, an imbalance psychiatry knew never existed. All, I repeat, 100% of all of the drugs sold to rebalance your chemistry in your brain are fraudulent because there is no chemical imbalance. Next, rethinking the effectiveness of antipsychotic and antidepressant drug therapy. Last year, the National Institute of Mental Health director, Dr. Insull, again announced that psychiatry standard treatment for people diagnosed with schizophrenia and other psychoses has not been helpful to many people and needs to change so as to better reflect the diversity in this population. Citing long-term treatment studies, Dr. Insull concluded that in the long term, many individuals who have been diagnosed with psychosis actually do better with no antipsychotic medication. With respect to antidepressants, 60 Minutes reported on what antidepressant researchers have long known. Placebos, sugar pills, do almost as well as antidepressants, even in drug company studies that are biased in favor of the antidepressants. The 60 Minutes report focused on research psychologist Dr. Irving Kirsch, who used the Freedom of Information Act to study published and non-published drug company studies involving 6,944 patients from the FDA database trials of the 6 most popular antidepressants. Here's what I would ban forever: Paxil, Prozac, Zoloft, Effexor, Celexa, and Cerazone. Also, psychiatric treatments may cause increased suicide. As I mentioned at the beginning of this program, the FDA, despite protests by the psychiatric establishment, has issued black box warnings about the potential for increased suicidality for patients under the age of 25 who use antidepressants. Last year, Alternet reported about a University of Copenhagen study comparing Danish individuals who committed suicide to match controls over a 13-year period. The researchers found that taking psychiatric medication in a prior year was linked to a 580% increase in suicide. I repeat, 580% percent more likely to commit suicide. Contact with a psychiatric outpatient clinic was associated with an 820% increase in suicide. Visiting a psychiatric emergency room was linked with a 2,790% increase in suicide. The admission to a psychiatric hospital was linked with a 4,430% increase in suicide. 4,430% increase in suicide. So if you really want to look at the science, if you want to look at the evidence, you're most likely to commit suicide if you're institutionalized or go to see a psychiatrist in a hospital or visit a psychiatric emergency room. And yet these figures are never released to the public or the mainstream media. And while correlation by itself does not necessarily mean causation, an accompanying editorial in the same journal where the article was published pointed out that associations with the features detailed in this particular study indicate a good possibility of a causal relationship. And among the reasons why psychiatric treatments could well cause suicidal increases, besides the adverse effect of medication, is the stigma and trauma of treatment. As the editorial authors state, quote, "It is therefore entirely plausible that the stigma and trauma inherent in psychiatric treatment might, in already vulnerable people, contribute to some suicides." And then we have the creating stigma with biochemical deficit theories. In the psychiatric establishment, it has long been proclaimed that framing mental illness as a brain disease or a biochemical defect would result in less stigmatization. But the Canadian Health Services Research Foundation, in a review of the research, reported, quote, "Despite good intentions, evidence actually shows that anti-stigma campaigns emphasizing the biological nature of mental illness have not been effective and have often made the problem worse." And this was published in Psychiatric Research. And then you have the corruption of psychiatry by Big Pharma. Big Pharma heavily funds university psychiatric departments, sponsors conferences, continued education for psychiatrists, advertises in their journals, and pays well-known clinicians and researchers to be speakers and consultants. I've documented this many times in articles and in The Drugging of Our Children, for example, how virtually every way the public and doctors get information about mental health has been corrupted by drug company dollars. Congressional investigations of psychiatry revealed that major psychiatric institutions, such as the American Psychiatric Association and several of their leaders, psychiatrists, including Harvard psychiatrist Dr. Joseph Biederman, were on the drug company dole, meaning they were receiving honorariums and money, creating what it should be, from my personal opinion, obvious conflicts of interest and further damaging psychiatrists' credibility. The New York Times reported the following about Biederman, quote, "A world-renowned Harvard child psychiatrist whose work has helped fuel an explosion in the use of powerful antipsychotic medicines in children earned at least $1.6 million in consulting fees from drug makers. Johnson & Johnson, for example, was just one of them. Plus, why psychiatry retains power, even as it is shown to be wrong? Drug companies need the general public to take psychiatric drug prescribers seriously, and so Big Pharma financially supports psychiatric institutions and its leaders. And Big Pharma has huge clout over the mainstream media via the media's dependency on Big Pharma's advertising dollars. So while Big Pharma is the most obvious reason psychiatry retains power despite a loss of scientific credibility, it may not be the most important reason. Psychiatry serves the needs of the powerful structure in general. And in our increasing fear-based society, psychiatry meets our own increasing needs to be controlled. Ruling elites and power structures, from monarchies to military dictatorships to the U.S. corporatocracy, have routinely used professionals to control the population by rebelling against economic inequalities and social injustices so as to maintain the status quo. So nobody goes to protest. Nobody goes out and demonstrates. Nobody stops eating their junk food. Nobody turns off the television. You just stay compliant, a drone. That's how effective they've been. So remember, it was psychiatry that assisted through the American Psychological Association in high-level relationships between the U.S. Department of Defense, the CIA, and other government agencies. As Truth Out reported, the American Psychological Association aimed, quote, to position psychology and behavior scientists as key players in U.S. counterterrorism, counterintelligence activities, and they oversaw torture. Psychiatrists and psychologists have subverted resistance by U.S. soldiers in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan via psychiatric drug treatments and behavioral manipulations. According to the Navy Times, one in six U.S. Armed Service members were taking at least one psychiatric drug. Many of these medicated soldiers in combat zones. Martin Siegelman, a former president of the American Psychological Association, has consulted with U.S. Army's Comprehensive Soldier Fitness Positive Psychology Program. And Siegelman achieved not only a social position of rank for himself, but several million dollars for his University of Pennsylvania Positive Psychology Center. And as the Philadelphia Inquirer, which quoted Siegelman saying, quote, we're after creating an indomitable military. Also, the pathologizing and medicating of noncompliance. Both psychiatrists and psychologists pathologize and medicate anti-authoritarianism and noncompliance. Many individuals diagnosed with mental disorders are essentially anti-authoritarians, and a potentially large army of anti-authoritarian activists are being kept off democracy battlefields by mental health professionals who have pathologized and depoliticized their pain. So, there you have it. Think well by the next time someone convinces you that you have a problem or someone you love has a problem, and you start on their medications. I trust nothing in psychiatry. I believe nothing they say. I have understood by writing articles, comprehensive scholarly articles, doing documentaries about them. They are corrupt to the core. There is no science, but they have power. And as long as they have power, they will use it. Now, for some additional things, from Penn State University, a diet containing a moderate amount of healthy fats, like avocado, is helping to lower the bad cholesterol. In return for this, it reduces the risk of heart disease. So that's good. Eat your avocados. And by the way, coconut oil is also great for that as well. Optimism leads to a healthier heart. Quote, from Health Behavior and Policy Review, individuals with the highest level of optimism have twice the odds of being in an ideal cardiovascular health compared to their more pessimistic counterparts. This association remains significant even after adjusting for socio-demographic characteristics and poor mental health. So being positive, being optimistic, looking at the glass half full, protects your heart. What is the ideal amount of vitamin D to take? Well, according to Dr. Virginia Stallings and colleagues from the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, published a double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled trial in which 7,000 units of vitamin D3 benefited HIV-positive children and young adults. And that was published in Pediatric Infectious Disease. How much for you and I, who are healthy? 2,000 to 3,000 units a day. Vascular effects of the Mediterranean diet. It is anti-hypertensive. This is from the University of Berry reports in Diet and Nutrition. Get on that high-quality diet of nuts and seeds, healthy oils and olive. They include fish and grains and beans, vegetables and starchy vegetables, and you are on a healthy diet. And finally, banned in 160 nations, why is the growth hormone in U.S. meat? From Health Impact News, quote, the fabulous taste of bacon is more popular than ever, but if you're eating conventionally produced bacon or other pork products, chances are great that you are consuming a livestock growth-altering drug so dangerous that 160 countries around the world have banned its use. It is called ractopamine, and it is dangerous. So my suggestion is, don't eat bacon, and you won't get this chemical in it that's bad for you. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Noll. We still have to discuss, don't believe everything you read about flu deaths from the Journal of Advanced Practice Nursing. Really strong editorial. And then we're going to talk with our guest in about 10 minutes, Dr. Dale Archer from New Orleans, about the rise of heroin abuse and dependency among young, educated, affluent whites. And he is a board-certified psychiatrist and a distinguished fellow of the American Psychiatric Association. It'll be interesting to get his feedback on my commentary just now. But we're going to take just a moment to offer a special to help the Progressive Radio Network, and here's what we're offering. This is a dilly. Last week, we offered Red Stuff capsules at the best price in our history. It was terrific. Now, we're offering the same thing for Green Stuff. Here's the deal. 300 vegetarian capsules. You're getting three bottles for just $49.99. This would regularly be $149.99. You're saving $100. $100 on Green Stuff. Now, Green Stuff was the first best-selling superfood. I invented it back in 1989. Why is it important? Why would you want to have Green Stuff in your body? Now, I never make any medical or health claim, but I want to ask you, what do you know about green kamut, K-A-M-U-T, juice? You have the green kamut, and you juice it. Wheatgrass juice, barley grass juice, alfalfa leaf juice, oat grass juice, broccoli juice, parsley juice, kale juice, pineapple juice, carrot juice, spirulina juiced, yucca root, and black licorice root. That's it. Nothing else. All those wonderful superstar greens, juiced at low temperature, dried into a powder, put into a bottle, and that's it. We've never had a price this low. You're getting three bottles for the price of one. Three for the price of one. Of a superstar product. If you only knew how many people around the world, including some very famous people, every day take their Green Stuff. Green Stuff, 300 vegetarian capsules, three bottles, 3 months supply for just $49. You're saving $100. Call 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. This is only until supplies last. 877-627-5065. And all proceeds go to support the Progressive Radio Network, so no other program has to do any pitching at all. Green Stuff, it is the number one. It is the best of the best of all. It does the most for you. 877-627-5065. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome, all of you. We're going to go to our guests in just a moment or two. But first, Lou Ann Panassi has just called in. And for those of you who are not familiar with Lou Ann, Lou Ann is a almost 40-year practicing nurse. She was the head of nursing at Long Island Jewish Hospital for 18 years, an oncological nurse. And she shifted her emphasis from traditional nursing to more holistic nursing and Chinese medicine. And she counsels people, but she also is the one who, since I'm on the road a great deal filming, and she reads people's concerns and emails me. But we've just finished helping our sister station, WBAI, where I've been for 38 years every day in New York, with a health retreat. And she's here to share a few thoughts. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. Well, I just wanted to share this phenomenon with your audience. As you know, and as much of your audience knows, when people come and they come to a retreat, it's not just about sitting and relaxing in a beautiful environment, although that's part of it. The people that attended last week, there was an amazing shift in their energy. And what I mean by that is they went from, I may be a victim, but I'd really like to make a change, to channeling all of their energy into something positive. And here's what happened. We like to start our day walking on the track, doing some power walking. And the first day that people showed up, they got around once, maybe twice on a quarter mile track. And after spending the week here, listening to your lectures, eating the food, enjoying the environment, grounding their energy, each day they went out with a new focus, and they went farther and faster and farther and faster. And here's the clincher. On Sunday, we had the Florida State Championships right here in the same town that we're in. And do you know, all 15 people came and competed in the Florida State Championship from the retreat. Every single one of them left with a medal. Now, that is unheard of. They went from being non-athletes to medal-winning state champion athletes, Gary. It was amazing.
I know. I was
see.
There.
Yeah.
It was exciting to see. Taking them to the airport, they were wearing the medals, and I say, that's just the beginning. That's, you know, you're right if you say you can do something, and you're right if you say you can't do something, but boy, there's a difference in the outcome and the reward you get. It was just, it was wonderful. And what we're going to do, Luann, is tomorrow we're going to play 10 minutes of people, unscripted, unrehearsed, just what they had to say about what they learned and what they were taking home with them. So it wasn't just a matter of relaxing, de-stressing, eating, juicing, feeling good, meditating. It was about transformation, and I was very pleased to be a part of it and to help. It was all for the purpose of helping the station, so that was a good thing. So we'll hear their words tomorrow, and I appreciate you sharing that with us, and congratulations because you won in your age group. John Q won in his, and it was just,
you won in yours. You got two medals.
Yeah, well, that's what happens when you do two races.
Excuse me, I think you broke a state record.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. So thank you, Luann,
morning.
And we will see you tomorrow.
Okay.
Now let's go over to New Orleans, one of the most enjoyable cities for me in the United States. I've probably been there 30 times. I just love the people. I love the music. Walking down the street, there's just something so transformative about it. But there's a gentleman who works and lives down in New Orleans. His Dr. Dale Archer. I mentioned his bio and background earlier in the program, and we want to welcome him. Now, nice to have you with us today.
Good to be here, Gary.
One of the recent crises that is finally being given some attention has been the rapid increase in heroin use in the United States. And the surprising statistic is its prevalence among younger, educated, professional, and affluent populations. And before the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, when the Taliban had literally wiped out opium cultivation from that country, heroin use and addiction had dropped off dramatically. Today, Afghanistan produces more poppy crops and heroin than ever before in its history. So there's a ready and very cheap supply of heroin flowing into the United States and other countries. However, in the past, heroin was thought to be a drug most commonly used among the downtrodden in the ghettos and streets and people and the uneducated. Now, that is completely reversed and it's becoming the drug of the haves rather than the have-nots. And according to the National Institutes of Drug Abuse, heroin dependence has reached 500,000 and has increased on from there. Last year, the governor of Vermont devoted most of his State of the Union speech to rising heroin use in his state, which is among the highest in the nation. And I had learned that in the very affluent township of Rumson, Fair Haven, in New Jersey, whose public a school system is ranked 25th in the nation by Forbes, the heroin problem in its high school was so severe that the school closed and all parents, without exception, had to attend a two-day seminar on the heroin problem. A similar situation is occurring in Greenwich, Connecticut, one of the wealthiest communities in the nation. So I'd like you to take your time and share your observations for the causal factors for rising heroin use among the affluent, educated, and professional class, and also please include in your answer how this may relate to the abuse of prescription painkillers and drugs like OxyContin and the crossover between drugs like Oxy and heroin.
Well, I think the easy answer is that it's directly related to prescription painkiller abuse. I mean, that is the problem. And heroin is really a byproduct of that. You know, about 15 years ago, medicine decided that we weren't adequately addressing patients' pain and that we weren't taking it as serious as we should. So there was a mandate that went out in the various medical journals saying you got to pay attention to this, and you know it may be subjective, but you have to listen what the individual is saying. And the net result of that is that there was a liberalization of the prescription of narcotic painkillers, and originally these were very rarely used, only used with severe pain, often in the hospital. And it became literally overnight an epidemic. So the typical story would be an individual who has an accident, ends up needing surgery perhaps, is prescribed by their orthopedic surgeon some painkillers to lead up to the surgery, perhaps help them recover from the surgery, without realizing the intense, unbelievable addictive properties that these drugs have. So we were hooking a whole generation of individuals, mainly young people who were more susceptible, but a whole generation to these narcotic painkillers, unbeknownst to us and many times unbeknownst to them. What happened about 5-6 years ago was that pill mills, or these pain clinics, started springing up everywhere. Now, down here in the South, they were ubiquitous. And Houston, for example, which is where many people from Louisiana would go because it was easier to get the drugs there, at one point had 600 pain clinics. And essentially these were clinics where you would go in and you would say you had pain and you would check off what meds work for you. And the average person would check off Xanax and the narcotic painkiller and perhaps a Phenergan to address stomach upset. So everyone had very easy and cheap access to these narcotic painkillers. And then several years ago, probably about 3-4 years ago, the FDA steps in and says, wait a minute, this is way out of hand. We have to regulate this and we have to step in. And so this was on the national level. This was on the local level. The city of Houston got involved in order to crack down on the painkiller prescription problem. Well, the end result of all of that was that they became very, very hard to get. And in steps heroin. In steps heroin because heroin was very cheap, heroin was easily attainable, and heroin was a quick substitute and an easy substitute for this pill habit. So you would look on the street and OxyContin, for example, may be selling for $25 to $50 for an OxyContin tablet, and you could get a small bag of heroin that would have essentially the same effect for under $20. Now, many people, when they initially made the switch, would say, well, I'm never going to inject it. You know, I'll just smoke it, but I would never, ever stick a needle in my arm. And overwhelmingly, sooner rather than later, many of these people ended up using heroin via intravenous injection, via needle, and were heroin addicts. So that, in a nutshell, is where we are today.
Let's look at this from possibly a little different perspective. We often think of heroin as a drug that simply dumbs down all the senses so that we can become numb and forgetful about our problems in life. It's the opposite of cocaine and amphetamines that became popular on Wall Street and among the high adrenaline power brokers who are constantly on the go. In fact, the most recent statistics have shown that cocaine and methamphetamine abuse is decreasing. So turning to the case of Vermont again, Vermont household income and home ownership rates and percentage of people with graduate and professional degrees is one of the highest in the nation. Its rate of poverty is well below the national average. So why do you feel there would be the attraction to heroin among a segment of the population that we generally do not regard as economically and socially stressed and depressed, who are not in pain, as you mentioned about the area in Houston where they couldn't get their pain meds. And what does this say about the level of contentment and fulfillment and a sense of positive direction and purpose in life among educated young people today?
Well, I think, first of all, in terms of the neurophysiology of heroin as opposed to cocaine or methamphetamine, true cocaine and methamphetamine are stimulants. But both of the drugs, or the categories of drugs, the opiates, which include heroin, OxyContin, et cetera, and the stimulants, both act on the pleasure reward center in the brain. So even though a side effect of heroin is more of a sedate, numbed type of side effects that go along with the drug, it's the euphoria from the initial rush that is the attraction of the drug. So you still get that stimulation of the pleasure center via the dopamine pathway that is the addictive quality in really all of these drugs. Even alcohol, we could lump that in there as well. So from a neurophysiologic standpoint, there's not that much difference. You have a craving for a drug that makes you feel good. In order to address your question, I think that it doesn't really go against the fact that, yeah, there are issues and problems in society today that would tend to turn, I guess, the typical upper middle class, middle to upper middle class individuals who normally were not using these types of drugs, whether it be crack or pain pills or heroin. And I think it all stems to our quick fix mentality, pop a pill culture that is basically ubiquitous, whether it's from the television ads for a variety of medications, or in my particular field of psychiatry, where basically we're trying to pathologize everything, where every quirky behavior is a diagnosis that needs to be treated with a pill. So I think that those two going together has led us to where we are today with this unbelievable problem.
I appreciate that insight. Thank you. As a social activist my entire life, I've always wondered why so many people would not become engaged in issues that directly or indirectly impact them, but rather just kind of set neutral and go about their life as if these other things are not happening, like global warming, for example, or the abuses in race relations, or the evisceration of our rights, and or the epidemic of obesity in our children, diabetes in our children, which are preventable. And then it reminds me of Dante, who said, "The hottest places in hell are reserved for those who, in time of great moral crisis, maintain their neutrality." And I'm looking at a younger generation today, and that is substantially different in how they approach life themselves than those of us who are older. I'm a baby boomer, and we had a little different perspective on this. And so my question is, shouldn't we begin to examine the meaning of life from a deeper level, our contribution to creating a constructive life, not just getting a job and having an education where we may or may not learn how to think critically? And shouldn't we also then spend a little time looking at the indiscriminate overprescription of painkillers by the medical profession and our healthcare system in general, which doesn't place limits on the prescription of opiate-based drugs to a degree that it would really benefit the patients and clients? And if there's extra cash for people, pharmaceutical companies, their advertising, their magazines, the television, to promote the idea that you don't have to work on preventing a condition, just take a pill and it'll be ameliorated, or you don't have to deal with life crisis, you don't have to we'll just give you a prescription and you'll take it. I just see that there's almost a metaphorical free license to prescribe for life issues instead of doing historically the hard job of sitting, counseling, understanding with compassion but with guidance to help people engage in a meaningful life or to help them when they are in a crisis. Your thoughts, please.
I'm going to answer, and I'm going to do it via my expertise in mental health, because I think that what you said is really summing up the issue and the problem that we're dealing with in mental health today. And that is that we're trying to define normal. And 30 years ago, normal was a big old box that encompassed a lot of different people with a lot of different quirks. And that was fine. We all fell within the realm of normal. But as time has gone on, the profession of psychiatry has started to take that normal box and shrink it and make it smaller and smaller and smaller, thus expanding the abnormal universe. And the problem with that is we tell everyone, don't worry, we can make you normal. We can fix it, but we can fix it with a pill. So not only are we making normal a very, very small component in the mental health universe, but everyone who falls outside of normal needs to be treated with a medication. And I could give example after example, but probably the most prominent one now is ADHD, where stimulant prescription medications have gone up fivefold in just over the last 10 years. And we've now got a rate of ADHD that's at 10%+ in the American population. Unfortunately, lost along the way is the fact that therapy works for a lot of people. But if you go into the typical family practice today, or if you go in to see a psychiatrist, you're walking out with a prescription, whether it's for sleep or anxiety or depression or a little bit of a mood instability, you're getting a pill for that. And the art of therapy has been lost. When I trained in psychiatry 30 years ago, the training was split 50-50, 50% psychotherapy, 50% medication. The guys getting out today from most of the top residencies get zero psychotherapy. It's all pharmacology. It's all about how to treat with a pill. And I think that sums up the problem in psychiatry, but on a grander scale, also the problem with society as a whole.
I believe you've hit it right on the head there. Final question for you, please. If heroin and opiate abuse today is becoming a societal problem and related to failures in both the medical and psychological profession, as you just laid out, the focus on that which is more humanistic, that which is more relevant to understanding what happens in life, and why can't we have a system that allows us to understand the transitions in life, when someone dies, when we graduate, when we leave a friendship, when we lose a job, especially now in these times of crisis where over two-thirds of the American public is suffering. Shouldn't we have some moral and social responsibility to help those people in crisis? They don't have a brain chemical imbalance. They have real issues they have to deal with, and not everybody deals with them in a calm and collected and manner. Many people act out. And I believe that we have to look at what happens if we don't help them, and then how many of those people are likely to use some form of sublimation or escapism that is not going to help them or society. Your final thoughts, please.
Well, I think that, I totally agree with that. And I think that, again, we're in a situation now where if someone dies that you're close to, or if you lose your job, or if you're having some other stress and you get depressed or anxious from that, that's a normal human reaction. That's not a diagnosis. That's not pathology. But unfortunately, we're pathologizing everything. So if you go and say, wow, my spouse died, I'm sad and I'm upset, again, the initial reaction is you're going out with a pill, with an antidepressant, with a sleeping pill, with an anxiety pill. So I think that it has to start with the understanding that the human condition is not flat, smooth, and mellow all the time. There are ups and downs, peaks and valleys. That's part of life. And until we stop pathologizing that, and saying, this is a diagnosis, you need to be treated, you are not normal, you need a pill, until we do that, And again, I keep coming back to the psychiatric profession because I have really big issues with my profession at this point in time. But until we can do that and say, yeah, that's understandable you're going through that, and perhaps we'll set you up with a therapist to help you work through and understand why you're going through this situation. Until we can get to that point, we're not going to solve the problem. And I agree with you. We do have an ethical responsibility as leaders and as professionals and as doctors to take the lead in this and say, we're not going to go along with the ads on TV that everyone needs a pill for every. We are the leaders. The pharmaceutical industry is not the leader. It should be the medical profession that are leaders that are, take the stand that we are going to tell you how the treatment is best suited for this particular situation.
I appreciate your courage in stepping forward and asking for a dialogue on an examination of the existing paradigm, because if we're honest and objective and we take a careful examination of all the modalities used in the last 50 years, we will see that when psychiatry was at its best, when it was its most effective, when it was actually able to help people, it was not based upon a brain chemical imbalance, give them Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft, or Effexor, or tell a kid that may be rambunctious or anxious, maybe bouncing off the wall because of an adrenaline rush from caffeine and sugar, maybe just more curious than someone or more distracted than someone, that now they have a brain chemical imbalance and will be stigmatized. That was when psychiatry did not do that. They just looked at little Jimmy and understood Jimmy and the relationship of society and his family and tried to work with him. And I believe that once we started opening that door to the quick fix, we saw that, well, we didn't really fix anything. And now you and a few others are asking for a reexamination and to take the paradigm back to where it is meaningful and helpful. And I commend you on your efforts, and I look forward to Better Than Normal, How What Makes You Different Can Make You Exceptional. The website is drdalearcher.com. Thank you for being with us today, Dr. Archer.
Thank you, Gary.
I'm Gary Nall, and that brings us up to the end of our program. And I just believe that we should understand that none of us go through life without multiple challenges and crisis. But when I travel around the world, I have found so many cultures where people were better able to deal with the crisis they also face because of the respect and the love for senior citizens who become the wise men and women, the elders, the council of elders, and every community of the world. And there was a time in America we had that as well. And the last great generation of people who had the patience, the insight, and the strength of character to help us was the greatest generation, our parents who were born or raised in the Great Depression. Our generation has broken that lineage. And our children, the X generation, and their children, the Y generation, the millennials, are paying a price for it. I think that there's a time to look back and re-examine the best of the past and bring it forward. Have a nice day, everyone. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Now let's say hello to Eutrice Lead. Hi, Eutrice.
Hi, Gary. Today, two battles. The battle to diversify Hollywood and a courtroom battle in Staten Island to defend the man who videotaped the police chokehold of Eric Garner.
That'll be interesting right now with Eutrice Lead.